Our third argument this morning is Spear Drake Insurance against All American.
May it please
Mr.
the Court.
Rubin.
Thank you, Counsel. I'd like to begin my argument by quoting from the organizational meeting that was held between the arbitration panel on this matter, the parties, and counsel on April 11, 2001. This is from record at A-496. The umpire, Mr. Huggins, speaking, said, "Mr. Mangino, who is the party-appointed arbitrator for All America, raised an excellent point which deals with ex-party communications, because the panel might want to rule on that depending on the party's views. Do the parties have views on the length, the duration of the continuation of ex-party communication?" Following this inquiry by the umpire, the parties agreed on the record that ex-party communications with their party-appointed arbitrators would continue through the close of discovery. The reason I've begun my argument with this quote from this passage from the record is because it demonstrates that neither the parties nor the neutral umpire had the impression at the outset that the party-appointed arbitrators in this matter were perfectly neutral. On the contrary, because ex-party communications were agreed upon and approved at the outset of this proceeding, everybody understood from the very first point in time when they got together that the party-appointed arbitrators were expected to be partisans. What that means is the party-appointed arbitrators were not neutral. This court has never addressed the question of what standard of review is applicable to the failure of a party-appointed arbitrator to make a perfect disclosure as opposed to the failure of a neutral umpire to make a perfect disclosure. This court in...
What was the relationship of... Was it Mangione?
That was the party-appointed arbitrator
for the other side.
For the other side.
What was the relationship that he had with All American?
He was, as far as the record is concerned, simply a party-appointed arbitrator. He was a retired executive of the insurance industry and had, other than the connections disclosed at the organizational meeting with the parties and their counsel, no connection with All American. Mr. Jack, the party-appointed arbitrator for Spear Drake, had retired from the practice of law 4 years earlier, had retired from Mayor Brown and Platt, had no connection with the company, Spear Drake, and had no connection with its parent, Fairfax Financial, other than as a party-appointed arbitrator at the time of the disclosure in May of 2001. This court in prior cases, particularly the Merritt case, has established a standard for determining whether the failure to disclose entirely prior relationships should serve as the grounds for vacating an award. The standard, though, that this court applied was applied to a neutral umpire.
Is there anything in the Arbitration Act that requires arbitrators to disclose relationships?
There is nothing in the Act itself, Your Honor. The only guidance would be Commonwealth Codings, a Supreme Court case that I'm sure this court is aware of.
But Commonwealth Codings didn't announce it as a legal requirement.
That's correct.
And what the Supreme Court said is that it would help people implement the real legal requirement that's in the Act.
Which is evident partiality. That is
exactly.
Correct.
So I'm puzzled why anybody would think that there's an independent disclosure requirement.
We have certainly
just
not...
Just not in the statute.
We have certainly not argued that there is an independent disclosure requirement. More than that, Your Honor, this court in the Merritt case has set as the standard for determining whether or not to vacate the failure to disclose, whether or not there was substantial evidence of bias. That is, whether or not there was the intimate relationship that was not disclosed, so personal, professional, financial, that it cast serious doubt on the impartiality of the arbitrator. The Merritt standard can't be applied in this case, because we have started with the presumption from the organizational meeting that the party-appointed arbitrators are partial. And therefore, the merit standard which the district court applied does not apply to party-appointed arbitrators in these proceedings. There's a recent decision by the Eighth Circuit, a very recent case in Delta Mines.
Well, that in some ways, that's the curiosity. The that under a statute that says all the arbitrators have to be impartial, we routinely have arbitration panels, two-thirds of which are completely partial. And, of course, in labor arbitration, we routinely have the party-appointed arbitrators as employees of the party. Union officers or vice presidents of the employer and so on will participate in the union arbitration. Now, how is one to understand that? Doesn't it look like a statutory violation?
No, Your Honor. The evident partiality statute establishes certainly that the neutral umpire must be impartial. But I think it also establishes the expectation that while partisan party-appointed arbitrators are free, that is, not bound to vote in a particular way. I do not believe that the statute expects perfect impartiality.
But statutes aren't animate. They can't expect things. The question I was asking is, isn't this whole institution of arbitration that includes party advocates a violation of the Act? Or maybe one could say anybody who signs an arbitration agreement, including party-appointed arbitrators, has waived the evident partiality provision in the statute for those arbitrators.
Certainly there is no expectation, and I think that the point that the court is making is, so long as the arbitrator who is sitting in the middle, the neutral umpire, is impartial, then the Act is satisfied. There is then a decision, whether it is 2-1 or 3-0, by someone who is impartial. There's no question in this case, there's no suggestion of partiality by the part of the umpire. And therefore, I think what the answer to your question lies in the selection of the neutral umpire, not in the what are sometimes referred to as the wingmen, the party-appointed arbitrators, who, as in this case, were obviously intended by both parties to be partisan. So whether this court applies the standard in merit, which we think is unworkable to party-appointed arbitrators, or the standard that was applied by the Eighth Circuit in Delta Mines, which looks for whether the award was prejudicially affected, there is no evidence here. And I think the court has to understand the real role or the real connection between the party-appointed arbitrator for Spear Drake in this matter and Spear Drake Bermuda and Spear Drake Insurance. Spear Drake Bermuda acted as the managing general agent for Spear Drake Insurance. What that meant was it underwrote the policies determining premium terms and conditions. Spear Drake Bermuda also administered the policies, collecting and accounting for the premium. Most importantly, Spear Drake Bermuda handled all of the claims, which means that it determined whether to pay a claim or whether to dispute a claim. There was no intimate relationship between party-appointed arbitrator for Spear Drake back in the mid-1970s and Spear Drake Insurance. Spear Drake Bermuda acted for all purposes save one as an independent insurance company. The only thing that it did not do was issue the policy which was issued in the name of its affiliate. Therefore, the connection that the district court found to be intimate in the first place was intimate indeed with, at best, Spear Drake Bermuda, if we consider whether a relationship has a human component in it. The party-appointed arbitrator for Spear Drake was never intimate with Spear Drake Insurance. So in sum, the district court made two errors. The district court applied a standard that is unworkable, that is applied the merit standard, which does not apply to party-appointed arbitrators. And secondly, the district court found that there was this intimate relationship, which is not supported by the record. There is no intimacy between Spear Drake's party-appointed arbitrator and Spear Drake Insurance. Moreover, the party-appointed arbitrator retired 4 years before these disclosures from the practice of law. Spear Drake Insurance and Spear Drake Bermuda were sold to a different company. Their management changed. By the time of the actual arbitration, the company was under new management and under new ownership. To assume that there was an intimate relationship with an entity that had undergone those changes seems to defy logic. Because the court made errors both in respect to applying the law, the legal standard, and in respect to the legal conclusion of intimacy, this court should reverse and remand to confirm the arbitration award. Mm-hmm. I will reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Rubin. Mr. Ammer.
May it please the court, my name is Andrew Ammer. I represent the Appellee All-American. Let me first address the court's question about Section 10A2 of the Federal Arbitration Act. In Commonwealth Codings, the plurality decision by Justice Black did say that these provisions show a desire of Congress to provide not merely for any arbitration, but for an impartial one. And in Justice White's concurring opinion in that
yes,
case.
Yes, but of course Commonwealth Codings was about the behavior of the supposed neutral who was actually at the time on the payroll of one party. Surprise. Well, there's your easy case. Let me ask you the same basic question I asked Mr. Rubin, which is how does one understand that a contract in which people agree that two of the three arbitrators will be party appointed as anything other than a waiver for those two arbitrators of the evident partiality rule? In labor arbitration, where, as I said, it's very common for those people to be current employees of the parties, it's impossible to understand it otherwise. Why isn't it appropriate to understand it the same way here?
Because, Your Honor, the case law dealing with tripartite arbitrators, an arbitration panel, the rules that typically govern these type of arbitrations, and the conduct of the parties in this case in particular,
I'm
all
asking
evidence,
a question about the statute.
It's not waiver.
No. I'm asking a question about the statute.
The statute, as interpreted by Commonwealth, requires that there be integrity in the arbitration process. There's no language.
So do you think labor arbitration is just systematically unlawful?
Absolutely
because
not.
Because two of the three arbitrators on a panel, or sometimes four out of five, will be just puppets of the party.
No, Your Honor. Arbitration is a creature of contract. And the parties
exactly.
can agree
and
in
And that's
the
why I'm asking the question whether one does not understand a contract to have an arbitration with party-appointed advocates as a waiver for those two parties of the statutory requirement concerning evident partiality. It's an agreement that those two can be evidently partial.
I don't believe it is, Your Honor. In Delta Mine, that's a perfect example where the party said in the arbitration clause that the party-appointed arbitrators
Maybe I'm just not connecting. If it's not a waiver, why isn't the arbitration unlawful root and branch? Because two of the three arbitrators will be evidently partial, the statute will be violated, and the arbitration must just routinely be set aside.
Because there is no connection between the ability to appoint your party's arbitrator and a conclusion that that arbitrator will be evidently partial. In fact, the cases recognize that there is no logic jump that you can make from
one to the other.
Well,
this case is a pretty good example of how this would typically happen. It's going to be a 2-to-1 decision.
Well, except
a very strong dissent by the arbitrator who was not partial. That you that were not impartial.
Except there was supposed to be a level playing field here. The arbitrators and the parties agreed on a process whereby the party arbitrators and the neutral would all disclose their relationships with the party. And if what Judge Easterbrook is suggesting is true, then why did the parties engage in that kind of a sham exercise? Because
well, that's
what
probably a good question. But this was really more like one-party arbitration to me.
Well,
and is there any evidence here at all that Jack's familiarity or prior contacts with Spear Drake influenced the umpire?
Well, certainly if you look at the process and the procedure by which the arbitration panel in this case dismissed all American claims without any discovery and without any evidentiary hearing, that, as the district court found, certainly is suggestive of chicanery that Justice White was talking about. But beyond that,
suggestive of chicanery, it suggests that the umpire didn't buy a particular set of arguments. In what way does it suggest chicanery?
Well, the umpire was under
we're
the
We're here in Chicago. I know what chicanery is. I reach into my wallet and I produce some chicanery.
Well, Your Honor, the umpire...
Any claim that that happened here? Yes. That's a claim that the umpire was evidently partial. But
well,
you're not making such a claim.
I think the umpire
Judge
was
Keeney's
misled.
Judge Keeney's from Indiana and I'm from Wisconsin, but we don't necessarily know
Judge Keeney put the entire bench of Lake County, Indiana in the slammer.
I think, Your Honor, the umpire was misled just the way that the party arbitrator... for All American and All American was misled. There was a process whereby all the parties agreed that there would be a disclosure and that disclosure was supposed to be meaningful. And the umpire listened to those disclosures the same way that the parties did and the same way that the party arbitrators did. So in deliberations, the umpire was under the same misimpression that everybody else was under. And it's not just the relationship that was later disclosed that's the key here. It's the conduct of Mr. Jacks in failing to disclose, and indeed, as the district court found, in concealing that relationship.
Was there a gain involved in this?
There was a relationship that obviously Mr. Jacks had with his former client, and whether it was, something that would result in further arbitrations for Mr. Jacks, we don't know, but we do know that there is, as the district court found, no satisfactory explanation on this record for why Spearjay's party arbitrator didn't just come clean with his prior relationship. And if the parties had agreed to a clause, like the parties in Delta Mine had agreed to, where not only could your party arbitrator be your lawyer, but it could be a current employee, then at least you're on a level playing field and everybody understands going into the arbitration process that this is something that the parties want. Here, it is exactly the opposite. The parties, by asking that there be a disclosure process that was going to be meaningful, had an expectation that there was going to be some degree of impartiality on the part of the party arbitrators. And the district courts applied the appropriate legal standard, which is the standard announced in merit. This court, in the merit standard, can take into account what the parties' expectations were in connection with what their arbitration clause agreement says. And certainly, if in this case you had the Delta Mine arbitration clause, it would be a different case. But in this particular arbitration proceeding, there was a disclosure process that everybody understood would be followed. And the district court's conclusions of law were correct, and her findings of fact that there was a deliberate attempt by the arbitrator to mislead the parties and his fellow arbitrators is not clearly erroneous, so it should not be overturned. And if the court sets the bar so high that it cannot be met, then we are saying that under Section 10A2, there is no evident partiality standard to vacate an award with respect to party-appointed arbitrators, and that's not what Commonwealth Coding says, and that's not what the parties expected here. So it's not a rule that should be retroactively applied to this case, where the parties had an expectation and understanding of what it was they were getting when they agreed to arbitrate. And if you look at the date that these contracts were entered into, and you look at the case law that was on the books at the time, and if you look at the rules that the various arbitration institutions have adopted for conduct of not just neutral arbitrators, but party arbitrators in exactly this type of tripartite system, then it is fair to say that none of the parties expected that they were waiving any right to bring a 10A2 challenge merely because the failure to disclose was on the part of a party arbitrator and not a neutral. So there was an expectation that the parties did have a right to bring a 10A2 challenge. There was no waiver. There can be no waiver implied by the circumstances here, regardless of what happens in labor arbitration and regardless of what happened in the Delta Mine case. This is a creature of contract, and the parties understood what they were bargaining for when they agreed to this type of tripartite arbitration. And there's nothing in the record to suggest that the parties thought they were waiving their right to bring a 10A2 challenge. I know Mr. Rubin referenced the part about ex parte communications between parties and party arbitrators, but that does not mean that the parties understood that the party arbitrator should be evidently partial. So, in sum, Your Honor, there was no waiver of the right to bring a 10A2 challenge, and that challenge was met here. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Aymer. Anything further, Mr. Rubin?
One minor point. There is absolutely no evidence in the record whatsoever that there was any gain involved by Feardrake's party-appointed arbitrator other than his service in this case as a party-appointed arbitrator. There is absolutely no evidence in the record, none, nor any suggestion in the record that the party, that the neutral umpire was misled in any way. That is why I quoted the organizational meeting decision by the parties and the panel at the outset with respect to ex parte communications. Mm-hmm. Unless the court has further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Rubin. Thank you, Mr. Aymer. The case will be taken under advisement.